This is Kelly Krager conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Joe Douglas. Today is 9 September 2013. I am in Lubbock, Texas on the campus of Texas Tech University, and Mr. Douglas is kind enough to join me by phone from his office in Clarksville, Tennessee. Mr. Douglas, to begin this interview, I'd like to get some biographical information if I could. Can you tell me when and where you were born?
I was born January the 11th, 1950 in Enterprise, Alabama.
Enterprise, Alabama. What were your parents' names?
My dad's name was John Douglas. My mother's name was Carolyn Douglas.
Did you have any brothers or sisters?
I had three brothers.
Three
John,
brothers.
Jim, and Jeff.
All J's.
All J's.
Where did you fall in the progression?
Number two.
You were number two. All right. Well, tell me about growing up there. Did you grow up in Enterprise?
I grew up in Ozark.
Ozark, okay.
Only because Dale County did not have a hospital. Coffee County did. They were bordered either side of Fort Rucker, Alabama, down in the southeast corner. And because they had a hospital, my aunt helped my mother through it because she was a nurse. And I was born in the boiler room of the hospital because it was warm.
Is that right?
In January.
I'll be darned. Isn't that something?
Yep.
What did your folks do for a living?
My father was a pawnbroker, and my mother was a housewife.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, did your father, was he involved in the Second World War in any way?
Yes, he was. He was in the Air Force. I think he was a Tech 5. But I don't know exactly what he did other than I saw him in uniform in pictures.
Right, right. Well, tell me about growing up there in Alabama. What was that like for you and your family?
Hot and humid. It wasn't a dusty town. It was just a small southern, not a whistle stop, a little bit larger than a whistle stop, but it was because it was outside of, at the time, Camp Rucker, and just north of Dothan, where the peanuts are. It was a wonderful place to grow up. It still is. There's almost zero crime there. I think the population there is right around 15,000 or 20,000 now. I don't know what it was when I was growing up. It wasn't half that, I don't think. But it was a community outside of Fort Rucker that supported it, and it was awesome. I loved it. I grew up in a community that there wasn't any racial tension because we grew up with white families grew up with black families, and it was just a lot of fun. I did not discover racial tension until I came into the military.
Interesting.
Yeah, and that was in the late 60s. So.
Well, what sort of stuff would you do growing up? Were you into sports, hunting, fishing, anything like that?
Everything. I was an athlete. I was a hunter, a fisherman. You name it, I did it. But I was a peanut. I was short in stature. Didn't make the all-star baseball teams when I was growing up because I was too short, too little. Didn't make the football teams because they were scared I'd get hurt, even though I was the fastest guy on the team. It was just, I was a little bitty guy that didn't get to experience the big time until I joined the Army.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, what about schooling? Where did you go to school?
I went to school at Carroll High School. Well, you want elementary,
sure.
Junior high?
Sure.
Yeah, elementary was Emma P. Flowers in Ozark through the 5th grade, then 6th, 7th, and 8th was at Ozark Junior High School, and then high school was 9 through 12 at Carroll High School.
Mm-hmm. And were you into sports there as well in high school?
Yes. I played because I was short in stature again. I got to run track. I mean, low hurdles were high jumps for me.
Yeah.
When I was in 10th grade in high school, I was about 4 foot 11 inches tall and weighed about 90 pounds.
Wow.
When I graduated from high school 2 years later, I was 6'1 and weighed 120. And I didn't start putting on weight until I went to Vietnam. So, but yeah, I was into all the sports. I was on the golf team. I was on the track team. Yeah, everybody knew everybody. You know, I think our high school class was like maybe 120 people.
Mm-hmm.
We probably had 600 or 700 people in the school. And it was a combination of people from Ozark, you know, Skipperville, Fort Rucker, that sort of thing, because that was the students could select what high schools they wanted to go to from Fort Rucker,
mm-hmm.
Ozark, Enterprise, Dothan. So we were a mixture of civilian and military brats.
Yeah, that would make sense, I guess, given the
yep.
location there.
Uh-huh.
Now, growing up in the 1950s and the 1960s, of course, the overwhelming international, the backdrop internationally was the Cold War. What do you remember about growing up during the Cold War?
I remember not much about the Cold War was put out to us. It was a historical thing, but you know, I don't think that the teachers or the people down there made it a big thing for us, because they were more concerned about us getting up and healthy, getting through school and getting out into the economy, more than they were about things that were going on
mm-hmm.
elsewhere.
Sure.
So it was one of those type atmospheres to grow up in. It really was almost like a Shangri-La, because, you know, we got to go and do anywhere, anytime. You know, at 16, you got a car, and everybody had homes on the rivers or on the lakes, and it was just, I don't know, maybe we had the wool over our eyes, I don't know.
Well, it sounds like just a terrific place to grow up, as you mentioned.
It is. It still is, yeah.
Now, when you graduate high school, first I should ask you, when did you graduate high school?
I graduated in 1968.
In 1968, all right.
Uh-huh.
Now, as a young man, 1968, we obviously know that the Vietnam War is in full gear by
uh-huh.
this time.
Yep.
And there you are, a healthy young man graduating high school. The draft is still on. What sort of thoughts did you have about your future when you graduated from high school? Are you thinking college, or you just know that the Army or the military is going to come calling one way or the other? What did you want to do?
You know, I think about that even today, because I think had my parents been college graduates, and you know, they probably would have pushed me to go to college, even though I did go to college, but I started out at Enterprise State Junior College and Troy State.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, I enjoyed eating watermelon and fishing more than I enjoyed going to school. So consequently, my grades didn't show well, and I had to go and, you know, make a decision. So because flight school was at Fort Rucker, I said, well, I'll just join up and go to flight school.
Hmm.
What the hey? I had, and nothing at the time, believe it or not, I did not look down the road. Nothing at the time pointed me towards Vietnam.
Is that right?
I just said, I'm going to go to flight school and come back here and fly around home. Literally. I was not into news. I hated history. My big subjects in school were English and math.
Mm-hmm.
I had no desire whatsoever, because at the time you were forced to memorize dates.
Mm-hmm.
I hated that. I said, who cares what happened in 1492? From Joe Douglas, they should have said, guess what happened back in the 1400s, almost, you know, and you know, the event. Who cares what day or date it happened?
Right.
In my book, I didn't care. I still don't care. I just know that it happened a long time ago, and things happen. It was just I don't know. I was not a date learner. I've since changed all that. My views have all changed, but back in the day, just wanted to fish and have fun.
All right. Well, so that leads me to believe then that even though the Vietnam conflict was again raging here and had been for a number of years, you probably, it doesn't sound like paying a lot of attention to what was going on over there. Is that correct?
There was nothing about Vietnam that was going on even in my hometown. Mm-hmm. I mean, this guy that had graduated from high school 3 years earlier, his mom had said, and he was a big basketball player. I mean, he was 6'6", big, you know, big dude, college degree, the whole works, went to college, but he got drafted out of college into Vietnam, so he went over as a helicopter crew chief. His mother knew somebody in the state Congress, and they made a phone call and said, get him back. He came back.
Hmm.
It was all about who you knew.
Hmm.
And that was my only tie to, in my brain, to what was going on in Vietnam. I said, because, you know, there wasn't a lot of news on TV for the TV that we had.
Mm-hmm.
And so, because it was small town, it, you know, not a big reader of newspapers and that sort of thing, Vietnam was no big deal.
Hmm. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so you mentioned that you went to college there for a little while. How long did you go?
About a year. Yeah.
So we're looking at 1969 then, roughly.
Right. Yeah. When I graduated in 68, 69, and July of 69 is when I signed up in the military.
All right. Now, why did you make this decision to join up?
Grades weren't. This is the whole thing. My dad, being a veteran with 100% medical disability from World War II, I had a college degree paid for.
Hmm.
It didn't mean much to me. So I didn't take advantage of it.
Sure.
And even though it was, you know, everything was paid for, it was like, God, I got to go to school again. Dadgum, man. You know, there's a lot of fish to be caught. A lot of deer to be shot. And it didn't interest me. And I didn't have parents that were college grads, so it wasn't important.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, all through the military, I just continued my degree until I finished my degree after I retired, mm-hmm. just picking up subjects here and there from different schools.
Right. All right. Now, you decided to join the Army rather than be drafted, so you could kind of control your future a little bit.
Right.
Within the Army. So you joined in, you said, the summer of 1969. Where did you go for basic training?
Went to Fort Polk, Louisiana. Oh, my God.
Tell me about basic training at Fort Polk.
I thought Ozark, Alabama was hot. Fort Polk was the most mosquito-infested, hot, dank, you name it. I mean, tar bubbling up on the roads. It was not a fun adventure. It wasn't much of an adventure to me because it was, you know, I was used to heat and humidity, but for somebody as thin as I was and didn't weigh very much, having to carry that big M14 rifle, that thing was heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And consequently, I was not used to that, but being the athlete and being in as good a shape as I was, it just got me in better shape, and I didn't understand what I was getting in shape for.
Hmm.
You know, because back then basic was to get you ready for the infantry. But I was going to flight school. I had signed up, passed all the tests, flying colors. They wanted me to go to OCS, and I said, no, I think I want to go to warrant officer flight training. So I decided to do that instead of going to OCS. And nobody explained anything. They just said, oh, okay, you can do that, you can do this, you can do that. You know, and I went, okay, cool. I did. And when I got to basic training, I said, why are we running and shooting so much? How is that going to help me fly a helicopter? So I did that, got through basic training, and it was off to Fort Walters, Texas.
All right. Now, you make it through basic training. Now, again, it obviously didn't seem like it made a whole lot of sense to you.
No.
Knowing that you're going to be flying, or at least hoping you're going to be flying. But you make it through. You make it through Fort Polk, and you find your way to Mineral Wells, Texas, Fort Walters. Tell me about your time there. Take me through your flight training there at Fort Walters.
Okay. We get to Fort Walters, Texas on a bus from Fort Polk, Louisiana. They won't let me take my car, so I had to leave the car at Fort Polk, call my dad and say, would you pick up my car, because they won't let me have it at Mineral Wells. He said, sure. So I left it with one of the sergeants that I was in basic training with. Anyway, get to Fort Polk. It's funny. They put us in formation. We're standing there with our duffel bags and our greens and looking all hot and sweaty and dapper and unkempt for soldiers. And guy jumps off the bus, and he's got this plastic helmet on his head that's all shiny, and he's got this baton in his hand. He's slapping it, and he says, how many of you new recruits? I need some volunteers. How many of you new recruits want to volunteer for what I got? Well, we were taught from the get-go, don't volunteer for anything.
Mm-hmm.
So nobody raised their hand. He says, okay, let me put it another way. How many of you people out here want to know what an airplane is? Everybody turned and looked around. Everybody threw their hands up. He says, okay, how many of you people ever flown an airplane? Everybody put their hands down. He says, how many of you people out here ever been on an airplane? Well, at that time, I had not. But four or five guys did, and those four or five guys, oh, you guys step forward. We didn't know what they were doing. We found out later that that's how they picked people to go to the fixed-wing course, which was really interesting. They didn't even qualify for fixed-wing. They just said, go. You're gone. So we never saw them again. They went to Savannah, Georgia, to Hunter Army Airfield for the fixed-wing course. And we stayed at Fort Walters, Texas. And we went into the snowbird status until it was time for them to assign us to a warrant officer candidate barracks to start flight school.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, we were painting rocks and mowing grass and typical dumb soldier stuff. Anyway, we get into flight school, and the first thing they do is make sure that we've got accounts set up for, you know, laundry and all those kinds of things. And then they say, okay, who's married, who's not married, blah, 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 blah. I was not, but my high school sweetheart, we were both pushing in the near future to get married. Anyway, then it started the, okay, you've got, you're assigned by room. There were four of us per room, two bunks each, spit shine floors with wax, probably, the wax was probably an inch thick on all the floors. No dust anywhere. And typical, if you were going to go to OCS or one of the academies for training, this is how you grew up.
Mm-hmm.
This is how you went to school. Except all we did was learn how to fly helicopters, learned aerodynamics, all that kind of stuff. Everything was aviation oriented. Unless you got in trouble and then you had to go out and walk around on the quadrangle out back in a big square and march off your demerits that you got because you didn't know how to, you know, your sleeves on your shirts had to be dress right dress, they had to be 3 inches apart, blah blah, and if they were 2.5, that was so many demerits, depending on what time of the month it was and how the TAC officer felt that day, how many demerits you got. And flight training itself, it was a challenge. It was hand-eye coordination more than anything, and it was once I learned how to hover the helicopter, it was like, oh my God, this is going to be a blast. And there was nothing about going to war, fighting, getting shot at, shooting at people, anything. It was just how to fly a helicopter.
Now, what helicopters were you training on here?
The first one I flew was the Hughes TH-55.
Mm-hmm.
I was one of the first classes. The classes before us said that if you were over 6 feet tall, you went into this type helicopter, which was the old bubble Hiller or Bell helicopter, the Bell 13 or the Hiller, I think it was a H-23 or something like that. The big bubble, you know, like the MASH helicopter.
Right.
Okay. But we were one of the first classes. Everybody's going to go through the TH-55, only because it was smaller, you know, less expensive, not as hard to maintain, blah, 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 blah. And it, I'm sure back then was just like it is today. It's a political thing about which helicopter company do you want to keep in business.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how they kept the helicopters flying in the military.
Right.
So we all flew TH-55s, and it was just, you know, we watched the films on helicopters crashing at a hover because of dynamic rollover, because of whatever, because of, we just watched them. Never heard of anybody dying, so we said, oh, cool. And if you got going more than 70 or 80 miles an hour in the helicopter, the front bubble on it would start mashing in, but and you had to hold your foot up against it in order to fly to keep the bubble from coming in, either that or slow down. And we just had a blast out on the countryside in Texas. And any time we went anywhere or did anything, it was all daisy chain.
Mm-hmm.
Follow the leader.
Right.
And it was crawl, walk, run when it came to flying out there. And I spent 5 months out there in basic aircraft. And then the advanced aircraft stuff was at Fort Rucker, Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
You graduated from Walters and then went to Rucker.
Right.
And then
right.
That's when you started out in the, did flight simulators and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, your time here at Fort Walters, your trainers obviously are making a huge impact in your life and early part of your career here. Who were your instructors? Were they Vietnam veterans, people who had been to Vietnam and had come back and are trying to get you acclimated, or were they someone else?
There were both.
Mm-hmm.
There were contractors, old civilians teaching us how to fly that had flown helicopters for a long time, I guess, and some of them were active duty Vietnam veterans. And it was luck of the draw who you got. And any time during the flight phase, they could get back with you and say, we're going to have an instructor change for you for whatever reason. And you just went along with it. Said, oh, okay, whatever. So you just, you learned all different types of techniques of how to fly.
Yeah. And at this point, did the Vietnam veterans, the combat pilots, were they offering you any sort of advice or, hey, headed to Vietnam, whether you know it or not, these are the kinds of things you need to look out for, or is it more geared at this point just to getting you to understand the basics of flying a helicopter?
Just to the basics of flying helicopters.
Yeah.
We never, ever heard of any stories about Vietnam, never heard of, to my recollection anyway, we never heard good or bad, or this is what you can expect, this is where you can think you're going to go, blah, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, never heard any of that.
Yeah. So when did you finish up there at Walters and find your way to Fort Rucker?
Oh, let's see. I got there in August, September, October, November, December. I was through, and I started in January at Rucker. January or February, I forget which.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Well, that must have been kind of nice being from that part of the world to be going back there for training.
Oh, it was, because I never got lost in the air like a lot of the guys did, because
sure.
They had no earthly idea where they were.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fun being the guy that could never get lost, because I could tell them, hey, guys, follow me. I know where we are. Right down there is where I shot my first deer.
Mm-hmm.
Or right down there is where I ran off the road my first time I ever owned, had an automobile, blah, blah, blah. And it just, you know, I knew northeast, south, and west very easily.
Right. Well, tell me about the advanced training here at Rucker. What kind of helicopter are you flying? How does the training differ? Take me through your time here.
At Rucker, we started out in the bubble helicopter, the Bell 13, to learn to fly instruments. And we started in the old, what was referred to as the Blue Canoe flight simulator. And from there, we progressed into the UH-1 helicopter, the Huey.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we finished our flight training in down the road, 4 months down the road. The whole school was 9 months in length.
Are you doing any sort of tactical flying here? What is the instruction like? What are you doing on a daily basis?
Well, during the instrument phase, we were just flying instruments. Head down in the cockpit, not looking outside, just piloting the helicopter, looking at the instruments and keeping it upright.
And how did you do with this?
It was different once I got the concept. You know, they weren't big on teaching concept. They were big on teaching robotics. Do this, do that, do this, do that. Why aren't you doing this and doing that? It's not making sense to me. What do you mean it's not? What are you doing here in flight school? Blah, blah, blah. And I said, whoa, dude, I got to understand this. You know, I'm one of these guys, you know, I probably need to see it first.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of thing.
Right.
And then once we got re-graduated from the instrument phase, but I don't know if you understand instrument tickets.
Explain that to someone who wouldn't know.
Okay. An instrument rating in the Army at the time was anyone could take a helicopter and go and fly in the clouds, fly actual instruments, and file an instrument flight rules flight plan and go fly into bad weather to get to their destination.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, there was no such thing except in fixed-wing airplane-type aircraft. In helicopters, instrument tickets had not been approved yet. So we had tactical instrument tickets. That means we graduated from flight school and could possibly keep the aircraft upright if we went into a cloud.
Mm-hmm.
And could not, and had no visual reference to the ground. But it was, as I look back on it, it amazes me that I got through that alive. because it at the time it probably made sense that day, but it never carried over into the next day because I was looking to have fun in helicopters. I was not looking to have to work. It's one of those things. But, you know, after you get through the instrument phase, you know, it's one of those, what do you mean you have a tactical instrument ticket? Yeah, it's a little card that you carry with a one-hole punch circle punched into the card, and you hold it up against the sky, and you look through that hole. If you see blue, you can go fly. Any other color, you don't go anywhere that day. Anyway, after the instrument phase, then we got into tactical flying, which meant the school book solution, Fort Rucker's school book solution on how to read a map, navigate from takeoff to touchdown to get from point A to point B on a map visually outside, and with a flight, either in the flight or leading the flight to that place, notionally dropping troops off and then coming back. No reason for it or anything other than we're going to teach you how to tactically navigate on a map.
And how did you take to this?
You know, we never carried troops, but it was all notional because there were no troops to carry.
Right.
But we did that for, you know, probably 2 to 3 months. We lived in the field a couple of times to say we're going to be tactical, and they had barracks out there for us to live in. It was like going to summer camp, but you had helicopters to do your job in.
And this was being done in the Hueys at this point?
Being done in the Hueys,
yeah.
Yes. Once we graduated from instruments, we went into the Hueys.
What did you think of the Huey?
I wish it was still around in the military and still an optional helicopter to fly. They should have, between me, you, and the fence post, they should have kept the Huey on board, but I know about politics, kept the Huey on board, upgraded it, and continued using it over the years, beefed it up to fly, versus developing a brand new helicopter by another helicopter company like Sikorsky, and putting it into the roles of helicopters when all of a sudden it doesn't measure up to what the Huey measured up to.
Yeah. I know that in other helicopter pilots that I've interviewed over the years, moving up to the Huey, you know, in some cases they say it was almost like moving up to a Cadillac. They really enjoyed the power, the responsiveness, et cetera. So it was really a terrific bird to fly. And this obviously sounds like it's the case for you as well.
Well, it was at the time, but I probably, the most fun that I had was in the TH-55 out in Texas, chasing cows, chasing deer. Yeah, that was the most fun because I'm, at the time, I was the sports car guy. Mm-hmm. I was not the Cadillac guy. It was fun being the Cadillac guy. I jumped into this big cockpit that was, you know, three times the size of a TH-55, and you go, wow, look at all the instruments, you know, and it just, as I look at it, look back on it, look into it, I go, wasn't much there to look at, was there? Compared to what I'm teaching to fly now.
Right, right.
Yeah.
All right, now, with your training here at Rucker, and the tactical flying that you're doing, and you've got, you know, you're becoming acclimated, of course, to the Huey. Your instructors at Fort Rucker, are you getting anything more Vietnam related in your training? Still,
nothing.
We're flying tactics. Here's how you handle it. All this sort of stuff.
Nothing.
Okay. Now, how long was training there? Did you say that it was 9 months training?
Right. It was 5 months at Walters and Fort Rucker.
Okay. All right. Fort Rucker.
Or vice versa. I forget which was. I want to say it was 5 months at Walters and Fort Rucker, but it could have been 4 and 5, but I think
sure.
it was 5 and 4. I don't remember.
Yeah. So when do you finish up? You get here in the winter, I guess, of 1969. When did you finish up your time at Fort Rucker?
I finished up in, I graduated in August to and made W01. Because when you go through flight school, you go through as a pay grade of an E5, a sergeant.
All right, and you finish up here in August, I believe you said, of 1970. Well,
right.
Here we are. You graduated. You're a warrant officer one. You're a helicopter pilot.
Uh-huh.
So what's next for you?
Well, they said upon graduation, of course, there was a class leader who was the number one graduate because of academics, scores on academic exams. The number one graduate got to choose his type of aircraft that he wanted for an advanced helicopter when he graduated from flight school.
Mm-hmm.
And he chose the CH-54 Crane, which was a huge jump in helicopter types. But he says the next 20 of you get your choice of OH-58s or AH-1 Cobra, which was a brand new helicopter in the inventory at the time.
Mm-hmm.
It had been around for about a year, I think, because we saw one of the first ones while we were at Fort Walters, Texas. It flew in and landed on a helipad while we were out there, because we thought that Hueys were the gunships, the old Charlie model Huey. And it was the gunship, but the Cobra was coming of age.
Right.
So we all made the decision. I said, I don't care about shooting guns and rockets. It never dawned on me that I was going to be shooting people.
Mm-hmm.
It was a gunship, and you had to go shoot on ranges.
Yeah.
I went, God, that is not fun, shooting on a range. You're not doing anything but hitting targets that don't move.
Mm-hmm.
Not fun. So I said, I want that little bitty helicopter, because it was new at the time also. I want that OH-58, and I was in the top 10 in the graduating class, so I said, I'll take that OH-58 transition.
Mm-hmm.
And consequently, it was another two to four weeks of classroom and flight instruction in the OH-58 at Fort Rucker. And I did that again also to keep me longer at home.
Sure.
Because I did not, believe me, I did not know that my orders were going to read Vietnam.
Hmm.
There were certain students that were assigned to other military bases in the United States that did not go to Vietnam.
Sure.
So I came down on orders for Vietnam after my OH-58 transition.
Well, first off, tell me about the OH-58 transition. What was the training like there? What do you think of this new helicopter?
I thought it was awesome because it was small, it was compact, it was fast. But the only training they gave you in an OH-58 was in the traffic pattern, how to take off and land, do a few slope landings for landing on, you know, ground that wasn't flat, or landing on pinnacles, which, as I look back on it now, was a joke. It was just if you're going to land on a pinnacle, let's go to the mountains. Let's go to a pinnacle. Let's don't go to a berm that's been made, you know, 25 feet tall out of a bunch of mud, plant grass on the side of it, put a concrete pad on top of it, and say, go land to that, call it a pinnacle. Yeah. But what they were teaching you was, when you go to land in any helicopter, you want to try to make sure that you're landing into the wind, because you don't want to lose that tail rotor authority, because of the tail, you know, the tail rotor keeps the nose straight, that sort of thing. So we did that for about a month, and I was an OH-58 pilot, graduated from Vietnam. I was having a blast.
Hmm.
And then it's when I got orders to Vietnam, and I went, really? I went, okay. Then I came down with a kidney infection. Right out of flight school, or right out of the 58 transition, I got sick, and I have never in my life been as sick as I was then. That's the only time I'd been in the hospital since I was born that I can recall. And I had a kidney infection from something, I don't know. And I was in the hospital, probably a month.
Wow.
Yeah. Waiting to go to Vietnam, so I had to go let somebody know, hey, I can't make this date. Oh, well, we'll take care of that. Here, we'll give you new orders. Come talk to us when you get out of the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Hell, I could have gone to Mexico. I mean, that's just the way things happened back then. I went, really? Wasn't strong enough, I guess, like it is today.
Yeah.
It's very, very strict today compared to the way it was. But anyway, a lot of stories in between, you know, about things that I did, just having a good time visiting relatives all over the state and waiting for my flight to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. At this point, what was your reaction to having orders for Vietnam? I mean, had you paid any more attention to the news, what's coming out of Vietnam? You hear the protests going on in the United States. The
None.
War's been going on for a long time.
Nothing. Zero. Yeah. We had no opportunity whatsoever to watch television in flight school.
Mm-hmm.
It was not available to us unless we left off the military base and went to, you know, relatives' houses during news time or something like, but which we never did. It wasn't important to me. I went, orders for you. Oh, cool. I get to go travel.
Now, what did your family think about this?
They didn't talk about it. They, you know, we never sat down and discussed it. It was just mom was coming to see her son off. And daddy and you know, the brothers, and I was, hey guys, I get to go fly on a big airplane. Woohoo!
Huh. Now, had you gotten married by this point?
Yes.
Okay.
I got married while I was at Fort Walters, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
I got married back at Fort Rucker because that's where she lived, and we married at a chapel on post. And then she came out to Fort Walters to live with me, and then moved to Fort Rucker with me to live also.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right. Now you've got your orders for Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
When are you going to? You're out for a month, I think you said,
mm-hmm.
with the kidney infection. So this takes us into what? Say September, October of 1970.
Right. I get to Vietnam in October of 70.
All right. Tell me about the trip over.
Let's see, the trip over, all I remember is leaving from Fort Dix, New Jersey on a big airplane. I don't even remember what kind it was. We landed in Alaska and got to go walk around. We landed like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. It's still dark, cold as all get out. Get to Alaska, then we jump back on the airplane, we head to Vietnam, we land there, and I said, oh man, this is just like South Alabama again, hot and humid. And we all get off there with our duffel bags and our TW uniforms, and some guy's standing out there on the tarmac waiting for us, and he says, all you new recruits, follow me.
And where did you land? Was this Tonsonute?
Yeah, it was at Tonsonute,
mm-hmm.
in Saigon. And we went to holding barracks, awaiting, you know, for the initial issue of all your jungle stuff, and then awaiting orders as to what unit you were going to be assigned to.
Mm-hmm.
And while we were there, oh, this is where the funny stories come in, because you're restricted to the barracks, not to leave the barracks and go outside. We assumed it was because somebody might capture us and take us away, and we won't be able to come back. You know, it was sort of a big game to me in my head. I don't know. I didn't take it very seriously at all. So me and the guys were laying there in the bunks, and we were discussing, you know, fighting mosquitoes. We had the mosquito nets down. They got in anyway. It's like they had little trap doors they had set in the mosquito netting they could get to us. So we were laying there in our underwear on the bunks talking about, you know, where do we want to go? What do we want to do? And we had been given the option to take two different types of pills, and it was for malaria. Either the little bitty white pill or the big orange one.
Mm-hmm.
I said, what's the difference? Well, the big orange one is for a week long. You only have to take one every week. Or the little bitty white one, you take daily. I went, okay, let's start off with the daily one just to see if it's going to have any effect. Because I was not used to taking any kind of medication.
Mm-hmm.
I was not, you know, I grew up and I didn't take anything outside of an aspirin.
Yeah.
And calamine lotion for poison ivy and poison oak. But I took the daily pill. Me and my buds all took a little white pill. We went back. We laid down. We drinking water and talking again. And that white pill hit me like a ton of bricks.
Is that right?
I said, oh, my God. And the bathroom was down the hill about 100 yards. And it was a trot to the outhouse by Willie Make It. And, I mean, I was running to beat the band. I got about halfway and just let loose. I couldn't hold it. It was, so I had to stand in the shower, walk back, soaking wet, change, and then wait for the next round. And this went on all night.
Wow.
Yeah. So I said, I'm not taking that weekly one. I can't do this for a week.
Yeah, it might kill you.
Yeah, well, after 24 hours, it was over with, so at least we were drinking a lot of water and eating anyway.
Right.
I said, I am not taking any more malaria pills. This is stupid if it's good. This is what it's going to do to me. So I didn't. And I never had any problem with it.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
So how long were you here waiting on your assignment?
That probably a week.
Is that right?
Yeah. We were in there for a week. Of course, we had to go through and we had to get all the jungle survival equipment and all the different Vietnam issue stuff that they give to every soldier that comes over there. And you go, really? Another freaking duffel bag to haul around? Holy crap. So my buddy and I, we thought because we were OH-58 pilots that we were going to be assigned to the VIP flight detachment in Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
I said, yeah, man, we got it made. We did the right thing in flight school. And then the sergeant came in. He says, Mr. McCormick, Mr. Douglas, follow me. So we went up there with him. I said, you guys have been assigned to Charlie Troop 3rd of 17th Air Cav in Quang Tri, Vietnam.
What did that mean to you?
Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Zero. I said, really? So we went over there to the map, and I guess he watched us, and we went over there and we started looking around Saigon and said, how you spell Quang Tri? So he spelled it, and I went, man, I don't see Quang Tri. country anywhere around Saigon. Dang. And he says, no, it's north of Saigon. It's an I Corps. And we both looked at him. What's I Corps? He says, really? And he pointed all the way to the top of the map. And I said, huh? He said, yep, that's where you've been assigned. I said, okay, cool. So we went back and packed up our things. We found out what day we were leaving and everything, and did not know at the time, you know, because we were being transported up by Air Force aircraft, and it left Saigon, and next stop was Cameron Bay, and we looked out, and I said, God, man, this is beautiful. This is like being on the Gulf Coast. White beaches, palm trees, gorgeous. And then they wouldn't let us off the plane there. Says, no, you guys are going on to Da Nang. I said, really? Okay, cool. Wherever that is. So they flew us on into Da Nang. And that was the last stop that we knew that we were going to leave, because they said, you're not due to go to Quang Tri until this date, so you're going to be in Da Nang for a day or two or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were there a couple of days, and we went into the HHC, the headquarters company room, and we asked the sergeant, hey, Sarge, tell us where Quang Tri is. We've been assigned to Charlie Troop 3rd and 17th Air Cav. And he said, yeah, it's over there on the map. So we went over there and looked all around Da Nang for it. Couldn't find it. He says, no, it's up there.
Keep moving further north.
God! I said, dude, that's like the DMZ between north and south. He said, yeah, you're right below it. Holy smokes! So we get off from, get our stuff, put on the aircraft the next day, head up to Quang Tri. They dump us right out there on the tarmac. It's an old Marine Corps air base with Pentaprime or PSP type runway, that metal planking type runway that they land on. Dropped us off and said, okay, all we know is to deliver you to Quang Tri. And we got off and looked around. No idea where I was supposed to go. I could have probably walked back on the aircraft and gone back to Saigon and just enjoyed my tour in Vietnam all around the city. Nobody had ever missed me, I don't know. But I went over and asked one of the guys that was hanging out over there, the closest person moving, and I showed him my orders and I said, we're here, and he says, oh, that's that building over there. And that's how we got to our unit. And it was a lot of fun, even though it was, you know, it was a lot of, did not understand, did not, you know, nothing computed. And I said, you know, it doesn't make sense what's going on here as to what kind of training I just received. And I saw OH-6s, I saw OH-58s, I saw Cobras, I saw Hueys, I saw all kinds of aircraft, and there was an Air Force detachment there with fixed wing aircraft. So, and we lived in Quonset huts that were air conditioned, which was really nice. But we had our own bunk beds. Each bunk bed was separated by a row of a set of lockers that you put all your stuff in, and so on and so forth. It was probably 12 bunks per Quonset hut, plus a kitchen on one end, and hot and humid. And what can I say? You walked around. I don't remember in processing. I just remember handing somebody my set of orders, and they said, "Report to the Quonset hut number so and so, and report to Captain Riviezo." I said, "Okay." There, off I go. En route, I think the new commander had just taken over Charlie Troop, and he saw us coming, and he looked down. The first thing he said to me, and I even say that to him today. He's a retired general. I say it to him today. You know, the first words out of your mouth to me was not good morning. You know, it was, hey, Troop, you need a haircut. And, you know, here I was in Vietnam doing what I was supposed to be doing, but I needed a haircut. And I went, really? Okay, cool. Where's the barbershop? I get a haircut. I'm easy. So it was a blast. It's almost like a blur. Everything went by so fast. Because, you know, they told us when we got over there, they said, okay, you're going to be assigned to the scout platoon, and you're going to be an Aero Scout. And I went, what's that? I said, well, you're going to fly. You're going to get a transition into the 086 because we still have both aircraft, but we're turning in all of our 086s, and we're going to fly 058s as scouts. So I got the transition into another helicopter, and then it wasn't probably a week or so after that, they just gave all of our 086s away, took them out, gave them to somebody else, and we got all brand new 058s to go fly scout missions. And, of course, it wasn't anything responsive like the 086. As a matter of fact, it was very sluggish compared to it. But it's all we had.
Right.
We had to fly with it. And it's funny, it was about probably a month after I left the unit, after I was shot down and came back home, they switched back over to 086s. And I went, wow. Anyway.
Well, tell me about your unit. Who are you going to be working with here? What kind of mission are they explaining to you? This is what we're going to be doing. Here's what we're talking about when we say scout missions. Here's who you're going to report to. Tell me about the unit and the unit's mission.
Okay. The unit that I was assigned to, Charlie Troop, 3rd of the 17th, their headquarters was at Zeon, down outside of Saigon. But they moved our unit up to the 101st Territory. That was their AO in I Corps. And they said, you're going to be supporting 5th Infantry Division out of Quang Tri as the Aero Scout, the eyes and ears of the 5th Mech Division, I guess it was called, in I Corps. In the tri-border area, South Vietnam, North Vietnam, and Laos. Said, okay, cool. Says, you're not part of the 101st, you're not assigned to them, you're just attached to the 5th Division, which was the Red Diamond, was the sleeve patch. But you're also part of the 1st Aviation Brigade, which is out of Zeon. So we were sort of a bastard kid in a big family up there.
Right.
And they said, your job is to go out and find the bad guys and report back to us where they are so that we can either take care of them there or go out and take care of them.
Mm-hmm.
I went, really? Okay. How do we do that? Well, that's what your training is going to be while you're here. We're going to show you how. I said, okay. And then that's when it started, when the instructor would take you out there. And, I mean, they literally taught you how to read footprints on the ground, smell animals, because you flew with the doors off in the daytime. And it was, you left at sunrise and came back at sunset. And because it was the 101st AO, you never flew at night, and you never flew on the weekends. But it was, oh, 12, 14 hours, maybe sometimes 16 hours a day, 5 days a week.
Wow.
And you had refueling out in the AO, so you never really came back home until it was the sun was going down.
Mm-hmm.
And you went out there, and your helicopter, a Cobra overhead, and a Huey chase ship.
And
the guns, and the baggers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what sort of things would you be doing when you're kind of getting checked out here as a scout pilot? What sort of things are they telling you? What sort of things are you looking out for? How are they preparing you to take on this role?
They would just say, okay, when we go out there, you had to learn to fly up there in Quang Tri Province without a map, because the Cobra overhead followed you on the map. If you got lost, he told you where to go if you didn't know where you were. So you knew all the routes in and out to get from Quang Tri to Kaesan to wherever out on the Laotian border, the different places, the different fire support bases and stuff like that. You just, over the days of continuous, and within 2 weeks, I was a scout pilot. So it was like, you know, and the life expectancy of a scout pilot in Vietnam, they told us right up front before we even started flying, was about 4.5 months. So I said, really? Well, guys just get tired of it and go home? I mean, that's how I felt about it. He says, no, they get shot down or they get killed.
Wow.
I went, that's interesting. Didn't bother me. I said, okay, cool. They're not going to shoot me down. So we went out. We learned how to read footprints, direction, how long they'd been there, if they had animals with them for packs, for backpacking. If you smelled them, they were real close to you, because all of your work was done down at about 3 feet off the ground, just hovering around.
Mm-hmm.
And if you did take fire, then you had to throw a smoke grenade out, tell the Cobra, 10 o'clock from the smoke, small arms, blah, 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 and you just booked.
Right.
And then the Cobras would roll in and do their thing.
Right.
And then you had to go back in and do a body count. And once you did that, day in and day out, 12, 16 hours a day for 2 weeks, you were pretty much trained.
Yeah. And do they turn you loose?
Yeah, single pilot then, with your crew chief in the back. Yep. And he was, they took our miniguns away from us and gave him an M60 on a bungee cord and with grenades. Then you went out into the AO and did it every day.
Wow. Well, you know, that might be a good time for us to stop here for today, Mr. Douglas.
Okay.
This is Kelly Krager continuing an oral history interview with Mr. Joe Douglas. Today is 10 September 2013. I am in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University, and Mr. Douglas is joining me by telephone again from his office in Clarksville, Tennessee. Okay, Mr. Douglas, last time we had you in Quang Tri, you had your check out there flying helicopters, kind of getting the lay of the land and understanding what the mission of the of Charlie Troop was going to be. And before I turn the recorder on, you were kind of giving me just some general idea about the types of missions you were flying. So if you would, tell me what you were going to be doing there. Tell me take me through some of the missions that you were involved in, and please feel free to offer as much detail in as many days as you can remember.
Okay. Well, the mission was to find the bad guys and, I don't know if the right word is eradicate, but was to stop the infiltration of the North Vietnamese army from coming into South Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
We really didn't deal with the Viet Cong that much. They were more down south.
Sure.
The people that we fought against, if you will, or were the North Vietnamese Army up on the DMZ. And my job was, as a scout pilot, was to hover around out in the area of operation in the AO and look for boot prints, direction, numbers. If they had water buffalo, you could smell how fresh it was, because you could, if you smell the animals, they were close. And of course that got your heart beat up. And it was, I mean, we found bunker complexes, caves, all kinds of things, underground tunnels that led to hospitals, inside the demilitarized zone, even into Laos, where we weren't supposed to be flying. And it was a daily mission to go out with the scout helicopter, which I had been transitioned out of the, what was referred to as the Loach, the OH-6, into an OH-58 as a scout pilot. And we took a Cobra with us for gun cover and a UH-1 with ARPS on board, the aerial rifle platoon, in case the aircraft went down, they were to come down and secure the aircraft and take the pilots and put on the Huey and fly back out of there, whatever, if it ever happened. But that, it was a three-ship team that always went out. They were referred to as pink teams. And once we got out to the area, that's when we dropped down. We always flew out at, say, anywhere from treetop to 1,500 feet, because the only thing we were worried about was small arms fire. Once we got out to the area, we dropped down, came to a hover, started hovering around, because, you know, intelligence had called back to our operations and said, we've seen movement, heard of movement, because, you know, the Air Force dropped sensors out in all over Vietnam, and when those sensors would go off, they would send helicopter pilots out there to check, see what it was. And I would venture to say that a lot of times it was wild animals, but for the most part it was North Vietnamese troops that were moving in across the DMZ. And every day that you went out there, you found what was referred to as the enemy, the North Vietnamese, where you were looking. And any time that they fired shots at you with their rifles, you would throw red smoke, a smoke grenade, out of the cockpit, and from the pointing of your helicopter being 12 o'clock, you would say, give a clock position from that, from where the gun was shooting you from. For instance, at 10 o'clock, would be off to your left front, and say, within 200 meters, and then you would break to the right and scoot along the treetops, and then the Cobras would roll in and expend their rockets and miniguns and stuff and do its thing, one pass or two, and then you would drop back down onto the treetops again and go in and see if you could find if they had done any damage at all. And you know, you could hover over the tops of their bunkers or their caves or whatever, and you would drop concussion grenades down into the holes.
You would drop them yourself out of your helicopter?
Sure, or the crew chief in the back would drop them. But depending, because I had them hanging in the door, I had them hanging on me. He had boxes of them in the back in the floorboard. And we would just hover over these little breather holes, if you call it. They were like little aluminum pipes that stuck out of the ground that were probably 6 inches across in diameter, stuck in the ground. That was their breather hole. It probably had a trap door or something. so that you drop a concussion grenade down in this breather hole, and you could tell if there was a trap door, somebody would see the door pop up, and then the Cobras would roll in again, putting rockets on site. Or if you knew that there was somebody down in there, to get them out, you would drop what is referred to as a thermite grenade, which is high intensity heat, and it would have them come running out. And there again, it was either them shoot you or you shoot them.
Right.
So that was a daily thing. It was all out around Quezon in the tri-border area, Laos, North Vietnam, South Vietnam, all up in the DMZ. We weren't allowed to fly into the DMZ. Those were the spoken rules. Those were not the live-by rules.
Mm-hmm. Explain to me the difference.
They would tell you you couldn't fly there. By God, if they were there and they were shooting at you, you went in and got them back. There was that, you know, if nobody was supposed to be in there, what are they doing there?
Right.
So it was like, okay, if I can't be in there, you can't be in there. So you try to run them out. It was a game. Literally, they uncovered underground hospitals inside the DMZ on the river. And we flew over towards where the Ho Chi Minh Trail was. We saw all the trails that came into South Vietnam. And they probably 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, there were people on that trail. More than likely, they were bad guys, but we couldn't really tell, because all you got to do is throw your weapon down or whatever it is into the bushes and be walking on the trail. There was no need to chase somebody without a gun, so we didn't. But, you know, it wasn't our job to be over there, so we were just over there looking to see what was there.
Right.
And, you know, coming back, we'd drop down and go into different areas all around Quezon, see what the Battle of Quezon back in 1968, you know, all the devastation it did. We fought bad weather. We flew in beautiful weather. We had aircraft crash in bad weather because they flew into the clouds, made a turn, flew into the mountain, killed themselves. It was, you know, I was there for the planning of Lamson 719, when the general came up, the four-star, and flew in, landed out there around Quezon. It was a little station, a little special forces station called Long Ve, south of Quezon, that they brought, literally, they slung load single-wide trailers in there with offices in them so that the general could fly in and then brief all these commanders on what the if we're going to do Lamson 719, we're going to do it this way.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to come around this highway, we're going to cut through this valley, we're going to go there, and oh, by the way, Charlie Troop 3rd of the 17th, you're going to make sure that we keep things clear for the convoys coming out, along with the other units that were congregating at Quang Tri. I mean, because we went from two units at one airfield to probably 15 or 20 units, and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of aircraft.
Yeah.
So it was exciting in that sense. I mean, I flew over you could see where it looked like the indigenous personnel were down on the ground. They were creating gardens, if you will, on the mountainsides. And we thought that was pretty cool, so we flew down there. But we were told about one area that was a no-fly area down the Dacron River, south of Fire Support Base Fuller. And they said, do not overfly this coordinate. So we had to put a circle around it on our maps and not overfly it. Well, scout pilots didn't fly with maps, but the Cobra pilots would tell the scouts, you need to turn west. You're fixing to overfly a no-fly area. Mm-hmm. And say, really? What's there? So, don't know. We don't ever overfly it. Let me go take a look. That sort of thing.
Right.
I mean, what are they going to do? Send me home?
Why would they designate these as no-fly areas? What was the purpose? Why would they designate these as no-fly areas? What was the
purpose? Between me, you, and the fence post, I don't know, because that was echelons above me, mm-hmm, as to the decisions of why they did anything over there. But once I flew over it, I would put money on it that it was a POW compound that we knew about, mm-hmm, that we were not allowed to fly anywhere close because we were afraid they were going to hurt our people. Because when we flew over it, the people that were down there were all dressed in black and had the little conical straw hats on. And you could tell that the majority of the people working the fields were much, much larger in stature than the people that were around the edges of the fields.
Hmm.
And I went, that looks kind of funny, but, well, I guess... must be a secret compound for secret food for somebody. I don't know.
Yeah.
So I didn't make anything of it. I just thought about this years later. And, in and out of fire support bases for our job was also to go in and pick up wounded or sick soldiers and bring them back to the hospital at Quang Tri. And we would, like K-9 units and stuff that were used to infiltrate tunnels. But I also learned how to fish from a helicopter.
tell me about this. I think I know where you're going with it.
Yeah, we would fly along the rivers and drop concussion grenades into the water, and it would stun the fish, and then we would drop down there and scoop up the fish, put them in the back, and we'd take them back home with us, and we'd have a big fish fry. Just enjoying ourselves while we're over there. It beat the monotony of the long trip out and the long trip back, because it was a good, hour and a half, 2 hour flight to the border. But in between, there was a fuel stop, so we would always be flying in and out of there for gasoline to keep us going all day long. And of course, the little boys and little girls would come running up to us with their little dart guns and their crossbows and all this, and was selling us teakwood stuff and hey kids, no thank you, we got nowhere to carry that.
And these people would have been Montagnards, I assume?
Not necessarily. They could have been the local village kids from the area, because this was not in the mountains.
Okay.
We were still in the flatlands before you got out to the mountains of Quezon, that surrounded Quezon.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a big... there was a big mountain just on the west side of the Laotian border that was called the Korok. And it was, you remember the mountain in, what was the, I'm at a loss for words here. There was a movie that came out about Devil's Tower, where the spaceship came in and...
Oh, yes, Close Encounters, that movie.
Close Encounters,
yes.
There you go. Well, this mountain looked exactly like that, sitting across, in the middle of nowhere, this thing shot up out of the ground. But they knew for a fact that there were cannons and mortar emplacements on top of that thing that shot over into Quezon. Put some bombs on it, dude.
But of course, this was not something they were going to allow.
Well, of course not. It was in Laos.
Yeah.
We couldn't fight over there, but the North Vietnamese could, because they were in cahoots with the Laotian people. Anyway, we knew that they were over there. We stayed away from it because we didn't want them lobbing stuff at us while we were maneuvering on the ground. That's also where a lot of little routes came in from the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Yeah, it was a daily thing to get shot at and shot up, and you know, you would take off at sunrise, go out, fly, come back at sunset, and then spend the rest of the night in the bar.
Well, that brings us to a good point here in the interview. I wonder if you might take the listener of this audio, or reader of the transcript, take me through a typical day for you as a scout pilot up here at this later stage of the war. From the time you woke up, what are the things you're going to be doing? I'm assuming there's going to be a briefing, there's breakfast, there's pre-flight, all these kinds of things. So take me through a typical day for you.
Okay. We would get up, we would walk over to, I rarely ate breakfast. Did not eat it, hardly breakfast ever. I would go to the operations building and say, well, am I on the flight schedule today? Of course, the answer is always yes. Says, well, what do you got for me to do today? Well, you and so-and-so and so-and-so are going to take a team and go out and look over this area here and then report back. And then we will call you and let you know if there's anything else you need to do while you're out there.
Mm-hmm. Now, is this based on intelligence, or they just wanted to put out feelers?
Well, intelligence because of the sensors.
Okay.
And we'd say, okay, cool, yeah, we can go do that. So we'd go out and look at the aircraft pre-flight, go get the rest of the crews together and say, I'll take off, you guys follow me, keep me straight, make sure I'm getting to the right place. And this would be, I don't know, 6-7 o'clock in the morning. We'd take off, go fly, and we'd go out there, get to the place, scoot around, look, report. If we found nothing, then we would say, okay, let's go back and get some gas. Meanwhile, bagger so-and-so, which is the Huey, let us know what the follow-on missions are. Or if we got contact, then the Cobras would call in. We may have to even, you know, land on a high spot to oversee what was going on down there and call in the Air Force or Navy jets to drop heavy ordnance on it because we found a big, high-level intensity set of coordinates that they need to, little rockets and rifle fire and hand grenades weren't going to do much for us.
Mm-hmm.
They needed bombs on site. Anyway, we would go get gas. While we were getting refueled, we would probably take sea rations or something like that and eat them, have a snack or something, and then crank back up, head out for the next mission. While we were out there, I'd probably call up and say, hey, I'm fixing a drop down. I've never been out to Quezon before. I'd like to look around it and see what's going on. I've been told this is where they had a lot of action. The guy said, yeah, okay, go ahead. We got you. And you go down and look around, hover around the bunkers, look and see if there was anything left that you could pick up and take back as memorabilia or whatever. And we'd take off and say, okay, tell me which way I got to go to get to, like, the cabbage patch. I said, okay. So we'd take off and go up into, we thought that the coordinates they gave us put us in Laos, but it was actually in South Vietnam. But we flew to both areas to see, and then that's where we started taking contact. They shot at us. We threw smoke. The crew chief in the back would start shooting, just to maybe keep people's heads down or whatever. The Cobras would roll in, expend their ordnance. The Huey doing all the reporting back to the headquarters as to what was going on. And then when that was over with, we would fly back down to the area to hover around to see if maybe we'd killed anybody or more contact or whatever. If we got more contact, then it was call in more Hueys, go back, get some gas, come back again. It was just a nonstop back forth. Come to find out, these guys were in bunkers in the hillside, so you could throw rockets and hand grenades all day long into there, and all they had to do was back up in there 20, 30 feet, and you weren't doing anything to that big rock mountain. So we would call the jets in. If you were lucky, they would put the bombs where they were supposed to and drop them like they were supposed to, because you'd give them the long axis of the ridge line and say, fly north-south to drop the bombs. 9 times out of 10, they'd fly east-west. And the bombs would go over the top of the ridge line and land in the other valley.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would say, okay, we need a BDA, bomb damage assessment.
Mm-hmm.
Says, we need a BDA for this. And say, your BDA is no good, zero. You didn't hit. Oh, yes, we did. We saw it hit directly where we dropped, blah, 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 blah. And I said, good God. No, you didn't. Yes, we did. So we'd have to go back in and do a bomb damage assessment and then tell them, no joy, go back. We'll call you if we need you again. You guys suck. And they, you know, all they had to do was just jump back in the mountain, start laughing at us and go, ha, ha, they can't get us, you know, that sort of thing.
Right.
But, you know, this was day in and day out. We'd fly back, get gas, go to another mission, go somewhere else, do something. You know, we had all of the Northern I Corps up through the DMZ and the border of Laos to play with. And even in the evening, you know, late afternoon and stuff, we'd land, eat more sea rations, get more gas, go fly some more. And by the time we got back to the airfield at Quang Tri to land, shut down, and go in for the evening, it would be dark. We'd be dead tired. We would go in, tell the guys in operations, y'all got the reports, what we did, what we saw, who, how many, blah, 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 blah. And they would send those reports to higher, and we would go back. You know, that would lead on for a, well, you need to check it tomorrow. So you're on the schedule for tomorrow. I need to go back out there. Okay, whatever. And we would head to the bar, which was a makeshift shanty that we called our officers club. You know, that we'd go sing our calf songs and you know, drink beer out of calf hats and all that kind of stuff. All that kind of childish behavior. And just have a good time, bunks the guys. And next thing you knew, it was time to get up and do it all over again. It was Groundhog Day.
Mm-hmm.
And you learned the area of operation very quickly this way, because you were always flying to the same spots every day because there was always somebody there. And that was a daily event. And probably the highlight of the tour was in February when Lamson 719 started. I want to say it started on February the 10th or 8th or 10th or something like that. That's when they initially started the push to the west. And we were flying convoy escort out to Quezon and somewhere around Fire Support Base Vandegrift, around the rock pile, which is a big deal in I Corps. Everybody knew where that was. Somebody gave us a call and said, hey, could you run up on top of this ridge line at these coordinates? We've been called and told there's activity up there, and we think that's where the mortars are coming from towards the convoy. I said, sure, that'd be a lot of fun. Let's go up and see if we can blow somebody up. We'd fly up to the ridge line, and hovering around on top of the ridge line itself, the elephant grass up there was probably 10, 12 feet tall, and came to a hover, looked down, and sure as all get out, I came to a hover over a 51 pit.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. It was about, the barrel was probably about 3 feet below the helicopter, directly underneath it. You couldn't see that from altitude, but when you blew the grass down, there it sat, and the guy was sitting there, and he says, gotcha, and he just pulled back on the triggers and blew 51 rounds, 50 caliber, basically, rounds up through the bottom of my helicopter. It went up through the back floorboard, nicked the lips of my crew chief as it passed in front of his face, took his helmet off, went up through the engine, and me and the captain that were flying together in the front, because it was my 90-day check ride in country. Every 90 days you had to have a refresher ride, if you will. It was by regulation, that's what they had over there, so you just lived with it. And it was my 90 days as a scout pilot, so they said go, and we came to a hover, and this guy shot the engine out and everything. We had just enough inertia in the rotor blades to pull the aircraft up to a high hover and then push the nose over and use all kinds of God's grace and ideas, and you know, you run out of all of that stuff about halfway down the ridge line and go, now what? So as we were auto-rotating, trying to get to the valley below, we ran out of all that ideas, rotor RPM, everything else. We came to a, had to do an auto-rotation to a treetop, hoping that the branches of the trees would hang the helicopter up as you settled into it. That didn't work. Aircraft flipped upside down from about 150 feet and just fell straight to the side of the mountain. I was knocked unconscious. The crew chief was screaming bloody murder because he had broken his leg in three places. The captain had been thrown free of the aircraft. He came around. He told me later, he says, yeah, when I unbuckled you, you fell. I said, yeah, I hit on my head, and it brought me back to consciousness. And it was from there we went and got out of the helicopter, slid down the hill into a creek bed, started digging, and the crew chief was screaming bloody murder because he was hurt pretty bad. And the captain had to literally take his sidearm and hit him and knock him out so that he would shut up.
Wow.
And then we performed as best we could to stop the bleeding on his legs and stuff. And it was, we were probably on the ground, 6 or 7 hours before anybody came in to get us.
What do you do, Joe, during this 6 hours or so?
We kind of made little dig outs in the side of the bank of the river and then pulled elephant leaves from the foliage around us over the top of us to keep anybody in the area from seeing where we were, because we were a good 300-400 yards away from the helicopter where it had crashed, and we knew they were going to come to the helicopter.
Yeah.
So we stayed there, and until it took that long, I guess, for them to get a medevac helicopter out there to us.
Now, you guys, obviously, I would assume, still have radio contact with the Huey?
No. The radios were in the helicopter.
Mm.
We didn't have survival radios.
Now, do you have any sort of personal weapons on you?
A 38 Special pistol.
Mm.
And, of course, a submachine gun that had been broken in the crash. We had hand grenades. But that was it. The Huey that came in to pick us up was shot down. Its co-pilot, or its pilot in command, was killed in the crash. The co-pilot was thrown through the windshield into the mountainside, and the aerial rifle platoon that was on board was thrown and scattered into the jungle. And I didn't know this at the time. I found this out later. But we had these, what was called a flare kit that we could use that would penetrate jungle foliage and pop a flare probably 1,100 feet into the air to let people know, okay, if you were alive, you were there. And when we heard the medevac helicopter over the top of us, about, I guess it was about 5 or 6 hours later, that's when I said, well, I haven't seen any bad guys. I need to let them know where we are, because I ain't spending the night right here.
Right.
So I popped a flare into the air, and that's the last thing I remember, because when the medevac came in to pick us up, the and dropped his jungle penetrator out to come down to where we were, because the trees were so tall, he had to hover down as close to them as possible. And as he was hovering close to the trees, the rotor blades clipped out a limb, and this 10-foot section of tree tumbled down. And, you know, anytime anybody looks at you and you're outside and says, look out, and they're looking up, you're going to look up.
Sure.
You don't look out. You look up. I did that, and the tree limb hit me.
Wow.
Right in the side of the face. They thought that had killed me. Well, when the penetrator came down through there, the captain threw me on it. He jumped on it with me and rode up. We got, make a long story shorter, I woke up in the hospital about 3 days later, and my eyeball had been knocked out of socket, crushed face, all kinds of stuff. But I had survived it, and the crew chief had survived, and all that kind of stuff. Next thing I know, you know, 2, 3, 4 weeks later, I'm in Japan. 2, 3, 4 weeks later, I'm in Eisenhower Hospital in Georgia, and waiting to be assigned to Fort Rucker, Alabama.
Hmm. And what was the total extent of your injuries, as well as the crew chief?
Well, mine was a fractured facial bone. The zygoma had been fractured, and they did all of the surgery through my eyelid to get the eyeball back into the socket in the hospital. I wish I knew the name of the doctor that did the surgery. Wish I knew the name of the medevac helicopter pilot. You know, I don't know this information. I've looked for it for years. I had a fractured zygoma. I had double vision. I had that for a year, even when I got to Fort Rucker. They asked me what I wanted to do, and I said, oh, I want to be an instructor, teach people how to fly. Well, you can't do that because you can't pass flight physical. And it took a year for me to get back on flight status for this thing to heal itself. Lost contact with the crew chief, didn't know where he went. But later on, like, what was it, 3 years ago, we had a reunion in Savannah, Georgia, and I ran into him after all these years for the first time. And we swapped stories back and forth, and he had broken his leg, messed up his face, gotten out of the Army, went into the Navy, became a submariner, spent years in the Navy, got out of the Navy, went back in the Army. it's crazy. And now he drives a cement truck in South Carolina.
And what's his name?
Bob Bunny. Robert Bunny. Good man. Probably one of the... what's the name of the dance that they do over there in the Carolinas? Kind of a shuffle type step. Anyway, he's one of those big time dancers. He's very competitive in that sort of dance.
What hospital were you taken to initially?
Initially, I don't know if I was taken to Quang Tri or I was all the way to Da Nang. I'm not sure. I woke up in Da Nang. I didn't ask. All I know is that when I woke up, I was very tired, weak. Of course, I was, 6'1", 140 pounds. I wasn't very strength bound, if you will. I had an IV stuck in me, and when I woke up, I had to go to the bathroom really bad. So I looked around. I saw where the bathroom was. I said, nobody here to help. Nobody has told me use this to call the nurse, anything. So I went, first time ever in my life I'd been in a hospital. So I went, okay, cool. I jump out of bed to go to the bathroom and crash, lightheaded and not knowing what it was going to do to me when I stood up and all the blood rushed. And next thing I know, I got people holding me up to go to the bathroom. And then we go back to bed and all this kind of stuff. And then I start getting visitors from the unit. They come see me, and next thing I know, I'm headed to Japan. To Camp Zama. But I lasted from October to February. And got about 600-700 hours of combat time. All kinds of crazy things.
How would you assess the type of medical care that you received early on and then later on once you came back to the States?
Well, at the time, I thought it was excellent because I didn't know what was wrong with me, but, it was unbelievable to me that they could treat something as bad as that in a makeshift, as they call, MASH hospital in Vietnam, the way they treated me. And by the time I got to Camp Zama, Japan, the doctor was asking me, oh, you want to go back to your unit in Vietnam? I said, are you bagging me? I want my mama. Hell no, send me home. He said, okay, that's okay. And it was really funny. And the doctors treated me well. Like even at Camp Zama, it was crazy. You could hear the guys screaming down. I don't know. They referred to it as like Ward 7. It's don't go close to Ward 7. Those guys are, there's something wrong with those people. And I said, well, that's like telling a two-year-old, don't pick that up.
Right.
So I went down to Ward 7 to see what was going on. I wanted to see my buds, see what was, why they were screaming, and I could tell. I mean, there were guys in there had wire cages around their arms that you could see the bones but no muscle, and oh my God, it was horrible. And I went, oh my God. And it was just another world. I mean, we weren't allowed outside or anything. Everything was kept internal. You stayed in the hospital, stayed there until it was time to board the aircraft and go back home. And we landed in, oh, where was it? St. Louis. I don't know if it was the air base east of St. Louis or in St. Louis itself, but that was our welcome home dinner, and they were going to feed everybody steaks for some reason. They said it was just what was done. So we got there, and it was like, oh, I don't know, 2-3 o'clock in the morning. And they opened up the mess hall, turned the lights on, and steaks were waiting on us. And it was the funniest thing. I was still in my flight suit and paper hospital shoes. And while we were going through with our metal trays to pick up our food, somebody dropped a thing of trays, and it sounded like hand grenade going off. Everybody in there threw their stuff in the air and hit the deck. Food went everywhere. And we thought somebody was shooting at us, throwing hand grenades, and it was, you know, 50 guys just going berserk trying to hide. That was my experience back home, if you will.
How long were you being treated in Vietnam before you were sent to Camp Zoma?
You know, it's hard to realize time, but I want to say maybe a week or two. And then they said, you've got to have better facilities, bigger and better doctors, whatever, so we're going to send you back to Japan and then let them determine whether or not to send you home or bring you back. And I guess they were looking to see whether or not I was going to regain my eyesight, because I had a patch over my eye for almost 2 months. So I never opened it, other than when they would put me out and they'd take me to the surgery and put me out, and then they would check the eyesight and everything and re-put the patch over it and bring me back out again. I never saw anything.
Yeah. How much time did you spend in Japan?
Probably a month. Because I couldn't see out of my right side. And I mean, I had no clothes. Literally, they did not give me hospital pajamas. I put my flight suit back on when I left Vietnam. And I kept that flight suit on until I got to Eisenhower in Fort Gordon, Georgia. I remember, I've still got that flight suit in my attic.
Wow.
Yeah. It's crazy.
That's incredible.
But they washed it for me and everything.
Sure.
I had to put on one of those crazy paper things where you tied it behind you while they went and washed my flight suit. They brought it back to me clean and everything. So I changed it. I probably had my flight suit washed every couple, 3 days, because, you know, I didn't go outside. I didn't get dirty or anything. So, but that's what I wore: paper shoes and flight suit, a two-piece Nomex.
Well, take me back, if you will, back to Vietnam before this awful crash.
Uh-huh.
Are there any missions that stand out in your mind in particular as you look back on it?
All the missions to me were just repeats of the day before. And we were shot at daily.
Was this the only time you were hit?
This was the only time I was hit. Only time I was hit, I was shot down that day, February the 11th, 1971. And all the other times were just, God, these guys are bad shots. I mean, they're sitting there, you're hovering. You know, it's not like you're flying 50 miles an hour, and you're hovering around on the ground. They shoot at you, and they only shoot at you. They never shoot at you from the front because they think you're looking at them and can see them. But you can't because you don't know where they are. And then when you turn away from them, that's when they start shooting at you. And it's funny, what was funny about the OH-58, because the engine was top-mounted, they were used to shooting OH-6s down because the engine was mounted on the bottom of the helicopter and behind it. So they knew that if they shot right there, the aircraft would come down. And that's where we got most of our bullet holes in our helicopter, was back there where the battery was, flying 58s. That was interesting. So we said, shoot, even if they do shoot us, they don't ever hit us. They can't. They are terrible shots. These guys are ridiculous. Of course, then again, you know, you don't think about the human thing doesn't come into account. If you understand what I'm trying to say here,
explain that if you don't mind.
You don't think about human to human. You think about cowboys and Indians, bad guys, good guys, that sort of thing. I don't know how to say it. If guys were to come to the United States to take over and run us out, and we fought for it, you know, it would be like us going over there doing the same thing to them. I guess. I don't know. But then again, when you think about the communist takeover, the communist end of it, no, we don't want the communism to take over. But then again, you don't think about that. You just think about, I'm going to get him before he gets me.
Yeah.
That's all you think about. The human element never entered the picture.
Sure.
And I have a buddy of mine who's writing a book about that right now, who it's almost like a love story, if you will, that he's putting it together, and it's coming out on disc. I've got a copy of the initial one coming out on disc. And when he gets through with it, it'll be released into stores and stuff. It's going to be pretty neat. It's a really good book. But he was one of these guys that before he went over as a pacifist. And I went over as a kid looking to have a good time. I don't know how else to put it. I tried to make something good out of something that was bad over there, if you will.
Sure.
And I was not one of these, you know, in those situations, you don't look at I don't even think rank entered into the picture over there, because even though it was Army, it was, okay, we've got a club over here that's got a bunch of helicopters that are going out looking for bad guys, and we need to come back and blah 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 blah, you know, and that sort of the day in day out issue. And we'd come back and we'd, you know, have our fun in the club at night and get up and go do it all over again. And there was nothing about yes sir, no sir, and all this kind of stuff. It was you called everybody by their call sign. And hey, 1-9er, yeah, 2-6, what's up? You know, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
There was no hey Joe, hey Bill, hey Bob. There was none of that. It was just a good time.
Yeah,
we enjoyed it as it could be enjoyed.
Right, that aspect of it anyway.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, we even had one guy in our unit that his relatives were kin to Roy Acuff.
Hmm.
And Roy Acuff was, at the time, I can remember the only Christmas that I spent over there of 1970, Lulu, you remember the big girl?
Oh, yeah.
On Hee Haw? Okay. She and Grandpa Jones and a couple of the other guys came over, and they did a concert for us in our aircraft hangar at Quang Tri. And because my friend, who had relatives in the country business, and we thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Yeah. Hmm. And they flew in, stayed a couple of days, and then flew out. I mean, just, I'm assuming they were going all through with the USO-type tours through Vietnam, but they did come that far north. I thought that was awesome.
Well, I wonder if you might be able to take time now and just talk about daily life there while you're in Vietnam. I mean, you mentioned USO or potentially a USO show here. Are you writing letters back and forth at home or to home? What kind of music are you listening to? What was morale like? What were relations like among the individuals in the unit? Talk to me about that part of the experience.
Okay. Letters back and forth to home were probably, I was writing, it was sort of like a diary. This is what we did today, blah blah blah, and you always ended it, I love you very much, wish I was home. And you just explained in the letter what happened every day. And as far as letters going back home, of course, all these care packages would come from home with, you know, week-old cookies and candy and that sort of thing, and dish pack boxes, if you will. And we passed all that out and kept stuff in the kitchen and stuff like that for people to eat. I never saw, other than that one incident where that troop came through. I don't even know if it was called a USO tour, just that I remember Hiscock was telling us that, you know, hey, I've got some friends that are sending these people over and they'll be in the hangar on this day and blah 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 blah. So, you know, other than seeing that, we never went and saw tours, if you will, like the Bob Hope stuff and everything. It was early on in Vietnam, but we never got to see any of that. What I did get to do on occasion was to take scout helicopters and go on reconnaissance and recovery missions to Da Nang and back. That's what we called them, but what we did was we went down there to see if we could roust up some fresh steaks or seafood or whatever, and then fly it back home.
Mm-hmm.
And we would take tradable goods or items, air cavalry stuff, down to the Air Force, and then they would in turn, you know, fill our helicopters full of booze and food to take back up. And we would, on the way down to Da Nang, we would fly the coastline. And you know what glass balls are that hold up fishing nets?
Mm, sure.
Okay, these were colored glass balls and we would see those things floating in the water close to shore, and we'd fly out there and pick them up, and we'd load the helicopter up with all these things. We'd take them back, and we'd hang these things over our bunks and our camouflage netting and stuff, just to, I don't know, decorate the place up a little bit. And each one of us probably had 15 or 20 of those big things, about the size of a basketball, hanging above our beds. And oh, by the way, you know, when I left Vietnam to come back to the hospitals, all that stuff that I collected from over there, somebody liked it more than I did. Because they got it. I never received anything from my unit from coming back through the hospitals afterwards. Anyway, we would fly, land in Da Nang, and spend the weekend, if you will, collecting things to take back. That's basically, if we left Quang Tri, that's what we would do for the weekends, was fly to Da Nang and have a good time, and then fly back to Quang Tri. Mm-hmm. But then again, I had a buddy of mine that was also a scout pilot. His name was Wayne Forbes. He's now a pilot in South America. I don't know who he flies for or what he does, but I have a feeling it's not your ordinary flying. He emails me every once in a while here at work, and that's about it. But anyway, his friends were in the press corps, and Wayne was doing all kinds of mysterious stuff like, yeah, if you come up here, I'll give you a good story. Come get in my helicopter, I'll fly you up, and I'll show you what they tell us we're not supposed to be doing. I'll take you to those places, and we'll go do them anyway. And you can write a story on that. All kinds of documentaries and stuff. There was even I don't know if it was ABC or NBC or CBS did a special on 3rd of the 17th. Back in the day, and it was from this press dude that Wayne took up there with him, that he was not supposed to, because this guy was a civilian, and you're not supposed to fly civilians on Army helicopters without permission. But he did it anyway. And together, these two guys owned a house in the part of Da Nang that soldiers weren't allowed to go into, because the city of Da Nang itself was off limits to all U.S. soldiers. Well, Wayne came to me one day and says, hey, Joe, let's go spend the weekend in my house in Da Nang. I said, what house? This is when I found out that he had one. I said, what house? He says, just come fly with me. I'll show you what I'm talking about. I said, okay. So we get in a 58, sign it out, head out for the weekend, says, we're going down to pick up some stuff. We'll be back in a couple of days. And we landed. He didn't make any radio calls. It's funny as all get out. We landed at a shutdown, non-active MACV compound that had a helipad on it. And as soon as he landed and shut the aircraft down, these Vietnamese dudes came out of nowhere with netting, threw over the helicopter to camouflage it, and then a little rickshaw pulled up. We jumped in it, pulled the covers down on the front. Off we went into the city. In our flight suits.
Wow.
We ended up in this compound, this house that had a brick fence around it, or stucco fence around it. Oh, my gosh, was that place gorgeous. But he and his buddy owned this place from the press corps. And I guess that's where he lived when he was back in town, and from the press corps, from all the things he did. But a lot of things went on in that house that for that weekend that we had such a good time. meandering with the locals, if you will. I'll leave it at that.
Sure.
It was the first time I ever in my life had contact with a food source called Nook Mom.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, "Joe, come here. I got something for you to taste." And lady out front rolled up with it, and she poured this stuff across these seaweed noodles, and it was called Nook Mom. And I went, "What is this stuff? God knows." He says, "Oh, you're gonna love it." So I took a bite out of it, and I swear it took the enamel off my teeth. It was so hot. Oh my God. I mean, and it was just, it was fish sauce.
Mm-hmm.
And we found out from the locals how they make that stuff. And they take fish heads and roll them up in paper, bury them in the ground, and then 3 or 4 weeks later, go back and dig them up and then boil them and put their spices and stuff in it. And that's how that stuff's made. And I went, oh. And that's when I had my first taste of Vietnamese beer. It's called Bom Ni Ba.
Mm-hmm.
3-3. It was pretty good, I guess, for what they referred to as a bottle of formaldehyde, because it embalms you, really. And that was one of the more interesting weekends I had over there. And we left and went back to the unit, flew over to Da Nang, picked up some steaks and stuff, and flew back to Quang Tri and back to business.
Hmm. Did you get any opportunity to take an R&R while you were in country?
No. That normally came mid-tour. I never made it to mid-tour.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wish I had. That would have been a blast. I had already looked at, I think, going to Australia at the time.
Mm-hmm. What about music, Mr. Douglas? A lot of folks, obviously, I mean, you think the Vietnam War, one of the things that tends to come to mind is the music of the time. What kind of music were you listening to over there?
60s rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
The good stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
Still is.
What was the morale like in your unit?
Oh, it was good, yeah. I know there were times that we would be sitting in the Quonset hut at night, and then all of a sudden we'd get bullets come flying through the Quonset hut, and everybody would be screaming, jumping for bunkers and in and out the doors and stuff, and come to find out that the guards, the American guards out on the towers were high on drugs of some sort and just started firing into the compound.
Now, are these American guards?
Oh, yeah.
Hmm.
Oh, yeah. So we had to squelch that. You know, that was excitement for the night.
Yeah. That's another important topic. What was, from your perspective, what was the extent of drug use?
It was there, but you know, unless you went to these all night card games and stuff, and these out of the way barracks or tents or whatever, wherever it was being held, you really didn't see a lot of it. But in the aviation arena, it was not as prevalent as it was in the other units, such as the infantry or the armor or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it was there. We just didn't see a lot of it.
Yeah.
Not a lot of the racial tension and all that stuff. It just wasn't there in aviation.
normally I ask someone, as their tour is winding down, the process, what it's like to be a short-timer, to be aware of how much time they have left in country. But this obviously wasn't the case for you, because you sit on top of a 51 caliber nest, and you know the rest you've already explained in that that horrific crash.
Mm-hmm.
What were your impressions before we leave Vietnam? I wonder if you might tell me what the your impressions were of the country, of the people, the Vietnamese people.
It was a sad situation, because the that's a culture that is just amazingly interesting, that people are trying to, if you will, Americanize now. And it should have, you know, they needed to leave it alone, because, you know, not everybody needs to be alike. Mm-hmm. You know, we got to have garbage men. We got to have lawyers. Not everybody has to go to college.
Right.
I mean, come on, people. Wake up and smell the roses here. We could have ended the war a lot quicker than it got ended. I mean, we could have come out the victors, but we didn't allow for it to, because we probably, I don't know, it politics got involved.
Mm-hmm.
and stopped it. But I mean, the Vietnamese will tell you now that had the bombing continued just two more weeks, the North Vietnamese would have given up.
Do you think you were aware of these political issues at the time and the way the war was being fought?
No. Not in the least.
Mm-hmm.
No idea.
Yeah.
I had a job to do, and I did it.
Right.
None of that stuff entered into my daily activity whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. You come back as a result of this injury, and you were back in, I guess it was Georgia,
mm-hmm.
At this point there, at Eisenhower. Pick up the story there. What was the treatment like that you received? Do you think that it was adequate treatment? Do you think they did the best that they could? Were you disappointed with the treatment? And then take me through the rest of your career here briefly, because you spend a lot of time in the U.S. Army, obviously.
Yes. I mean, Eisenhower, again, was hot and humid. It was like being in Vietnam. It was like being in South Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I, you know, was reunited with the family.
What was that like?
Oh, it was unbelievable. You know, mom, dad, the wife, they all came up and just stayed with me until I got out. I was there for maybe a week and a half, and they sent me to Fort Rucker.
Did they know the extent of your injuries?
Oh, yeah.
Before you came back to the States?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah, I had talked to the wife from Japan, but it wasn't for very long, because they would call you to a telephone in the hospital and say, you've got 45 seconds on the air, make it quick, that sort of thing. So it was, hi, how you doing, what's going on, okay, time's up. And you know, you got out as much as you could in the time you were allotted to talk to them. So they pretty much knew. And that's why they were there waiting on me when I got there.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Once you're released from Eisenhower, you go back to Fort Rucker. What's going to be the extent of your role there?
That's when it gets hilarious. Because I reported to Fort Rucker with a set of orders saying, you're assigned from Eisenhower to Fort Rucker. And Fort Rucker looks and he says, who are you? Well, I'm so-and-so, W-01 so-and-so. I said, but you don't exist. Where? What do you mean, Eisenhower? We don't have aviation unit Eisenhower, that sort of thing. And I said, where are your flight records? Where are your medical records? Where's this? Where's that? I don't have any of that stuff. In traveling from hospital to hospital, they send records from hospital headquarters to hospital headquarters. You can call the hospital and get those information if you want it. But where are your flight records? I was shot down in Vietnam and came through the hospitals. I don't have my flight records. Catch a clue, buddy. When'd you graduate from flight school? And I told him, I says, where are your orders for that? And I said, dude, really? Do I look like I carry my life around with me in a briefcase? Are you kidding me? So I had to go back and find all of this stuff, but it was a process, a length of time, you know, there for about a week or two that I got with these people and said, you know, okay, here's what I have. They looked at it and then they decided that, well, you can't go on flight status because of your injury until the flight surgeon clears you back to flight. So you can either be a tactical officer in the WAC companies, or you can go be an academic instructor for the flight line, or you can go to armory, or you can go to this, or go. And I said, well, I've always wanted to be an instructor pilot, so I'll go be an academic instructor. So they sent me through their academic instruction school at Rucker, and waiting for me to get back on flight status. I had to recoup all of my records. How much flight time do you have? And I told him. He said, there's no way. A W-1, no way. I said, well, until you put your butt in my boots, don't tell me there's no way, because I did that every day, day in and day out, 5 days a week. You add up the numbers. And it was almost like a pissing contest with guys that had nothing better to do than to look pretty behind a desk. And but it all got straightened out. It took about 2 or 3 months to get all that straightened out with the paper pushers, or if you will, at Rucker. And then it took about a year of academic instruction for me to get back on flight status. And then once back on flight status is when they said, okay, we're going to allow all academic instructors to be flight line instructor pilots in the aircraft that they teach. And I taught the OH-58 and OH-6 IP course at Rucker for about 3 years. And in the meantime, while I was there doing that, I was submitting records or submitting paperwork to finish my degree and do all kinds of stuff as per the regulation. And oh, you didn't get this signed right. Oh, this didn't go through the right person. This didn't get that. This didn't hum and hum and hum. I said, good God. I tell you what, I submitted paperwork to get out of the Army. Oh, I didn't get this. You didn't get this signature. It didn't go through the right channels. It never got to this position. Blah, 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 blah. And I just got tired of fighting the system, so I just rolled with the punches. 24 years later, I'm out.
Well, I wonder if you, because you're in a really good position, I think, perhaps to discuss this. The military in general, and certainly the Army, there are issues that the United States face. There were discipline issues, there were morale issues, drugs, race, all of these kinds of things kind of coming together. And the negative or the nasty taste in the mouth of the American public toward the military in a lot of different ways. What was it like to remain in the Army in the post-Vietnam War era? What sort of issues did you see come up? What sort of resolutions were attempted to address these issues? How did you see the military and the Army in particular change over the course of your time in the Army?
Well, you know, I've never really thought about it. I didn't see that type of impact that you're speaking of at all at Fort Rucker in the 70s. And, of course, I stayed my 3.5 to 4 years at Fort Rucker and as an instructor pilot, and then I was put on orders to go to Europe. So I was out of the United States. We didn't have those issues down there. They weren't there. They weren't prevalent at all doing what we did, because it was a flight school at Fort Rucker. It wasn't a unit preparing to go to war. Or even, you didn't prepare people for war at Fort Rucker. You prepared them for, you can fly a helicopter now go to a unit that fights.
Right. And a lot of these guys are going to be, you know, pretty motivated individuals, professionals in what they're doing. And so perhaps you, that may have been a part of it as well.
Uh-huh.
What about the war in Vietnam itself? The United States officially is finished in terms of, you know, boots on the ground and active combat operations there in late 72, early 73. What was your opinion of the way the war ended? When Saigon falls in 75, were you aware of it? Was it a concern for you?
I was aware of it at the time. I couldn't believe it was happening. As strong as we were as a military force, that we allowed a third world country to dominate the way they did. But it was all politics, 100%. I mean, I'm a firm believer that we left people over there in Laos, North Vietnam, China, that they're still there. I was on a mission 15 years later to go back and rescue them.
Is that right?
That got called off. Yep.
Do you care to discuss that?
I can't.
Okay.
I could over a beer.
Right.
Not over the phone.
I understand. I understand.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, just a couple more questions for you, for the interview with Mr. Douglas, and feel free to expand on as much as you'd like or as little as you'd like, but when you look back at your experiences in Vietnam, how would you say they most affected your life?
Probably maybe want to travel more, see other countries, other cultures.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But the war end of it, it was not, I don't know, it really didn't seem like a war. I don't know. It was, got me out of Southeast Alabama, what can I say?
Yeah. Out of Southeast Alabama into Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
Anyway.
The only thing I didn't see over there that we had in Southeast Alabama were peanut patches, you know?
Hmm. Yeah. Well, my last question for you, again, is can be a rather broad one depending on how you look at it. But over the years, we've looked at, as a society, as a country, we've looked at the Vietnam War in a variety of different ways and say, these are the lessons of Vietnam. These were the lessons of Vietnam. And I think we've been struggling over the last 40, 50 years to determine just what the legacy of the Vietnam War was. As someone who was there, as someone who was involved in combat, shot down, what do you think it is? What is the legacy of the Vietnam War? What do we take out of the Vietnam War?
Probably that we shouldn't have been there. It was another political issue with the French. Between me, you, and the fence post, you can't trust those idiots anyway. They're two peace loving, but they want to control.
Mm-hmm.
And we tried to use them as allies, and it backfired, and all kinds of stuff. We should not have been there in the first place. But if we were there, we could have won and stopped whatever the aggression was. But we chose not to,
mm-hmm.
for whatever reason. I'm sure it was political.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Douglas, is there anything else you'd like to add to the interview before we bring it to a close?
Not for today.
All right, well, if there's nothing further, then I guess we can go ahead and end the interview.
Okay.